You are the chairman, board of trustees of the AU COVID-19 Response Fund. The first question is, what are your three key achievements so far? And what are the challenges that you have faced?
Well, thank you very much. The COVID Response Fund was created as an emergency response by the African Union to the pandemic. And I think it was created essentially to make it easier for the continent to respond on a whole of Africa approach. You know, we have 55 countries, fragmented countries, and if you recall, if you take your mind back to April last year, around April last year, the big issues were the PPEs, test kits, you know, and the big economies, we had money, we were going buying up all those things, and Africans couldn't buy. The manufacturers were not going to listen to small economies coming to just place orders for a few million dollars or a few hundred thousand. So the response fund was intended to help us deal with these issues. So what we did as soon as we were created, of course, was to set up the structures that will make it possible for us to operate, to be able to do this in an effective way. Two areas we're asked to intervene in. One is help mobilize funds. The second is help the utilization of the fund. So we quickly created two key subcommittees, one that does the mobilization and one responsible for the utilization. In all of these, of course, we are serving essentially the Africa CDC. So we knew that money was critical because there were a few other things that were happening in parallel that required that we support the African CDC to be able to do what I said, the food procurement. So we were able to launch the fund mobilization early enough with support of the African Union, with President Cyril Ramaphosa, who was the chairperson of the African Union at that time. Of course, the chairman, Musa Faki, Dr. John Kegerson, the director of Africa CDC, Amina Fadil, who was then, and she still is, the commissioner for social affairs. I'll say that today, combined some of the funds that we have raised, exceeded the pledges we got, exceeded about almost getting to about $60 million. Of course, we've been able to get some of these pledges redeemed, below about $30 million. So we are pushing to make sure we get all the pledges redeemed. And this came largely from African states, from also the development partners of the African Union, some of the countries, the European Union, the British government, the German government, and so on, who supported.
So do you have enough funds as we speak?
Yeah, but I want to say we don't have enough funds because as we get the money, we use it. Because of that is on the other side of the utilization. But on the mobilization, as I mentioned, I think we have a healthy pipeline of pledges we should draw upon and we should collect. Because we also did we organized a show to make sure that the private sector also participated, and many of them also made pledges. So what we're doing now in two fronts is to make sure that we convert the pledges to cash, and these pledges from the government, from the development partners, from the private. If we do that, we will be able to have additional $20-30 million paid very quickly, because the pledges have been made. Then the other one is raising more money. For that purpose, we've hired a fund mobilization consultant who just joined us. She will also help us do this not only mobilization, but also to get the pledges converted. Now, you ask a question, do we have enough money? No, the needs are so many. Because, you know, we are funding the rapid responders. We are funding countries who need to get therapeutics. Even now, with the vaccine issues going on, we're supporting the Africa CDC as they prepare the rollout of the vaccine. So we are really, the fund is really in need of funds to be able to do all the work that it needs to do. And that is why we are planning a revamped fund mobilization initiative to make sure that we complement the other funds that will be mobilized also through the Africa CDC. Because we mobilize funds, we also mobilize, we promote. People can donate to Africa CDC or donate to the fund. And if we add all the money raised together through this approach, apart from those that the Africa CDC raised separately, you will be talking about pledges of more than $100 million. But I didn't talk about those, because some of those donors pledged those directly to the Africa CDC.
So is it fair to say that getting people who have pledged to redeem their pledges is a challenge?
Well, you know, things are difficult these days. You know very well, everybody, companies are struggling, countries are struggling. To that extent, the redemption of the pledges is coming at a slower pace than expected. However, I must really commend many of the African economies, many African countries, that despite all the challenges, have come out and even not only made the pledges, but paid up. There are a few that we still are pursuing to make their own pledges, just like other countries have done. Because the benefit of doing that, you see, the work of the fund makes it easier. For what I mentioned earlier, the whole of Africa pushed to the way intervention is being done. I give an example. We supported the procurement of dexamethasone drugs. You know, it's one of the drugs that are being used to deal with the COVID in terms of treatment. Now, part of the funding came from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, so we matched it and all that. But we also talk about the logistics, because see, unless we as a fund were able to cover the logistics, the fact of it is that the island economies will pay more than, say, the countries on the continent. So when we do a pooled procurement, we actually do a fair and equitable distribution of some of these products, because everybody gets it at the same time, and also at no extra cost. So that is why we are just pleading with the African countries that have not pledged to pledge, those that have pledged who have not redeemed to please redeem, while also appealing to donors, and these include African businesses, to make donations. And I must say, I acknowledge also some of the donations we've received on the vaccine front. For example, the MTN, I didn't include this in the funding mobilized, because we separated the donations that have come through the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team. But these are donations that have come also to support some of the COVID interventions. So the MTN that have pledged about $25 million, and we've used it to supply vaccines that we used to even supply more. So we're asking companies such as MTN, countries, and not development partners, other countries that have not supported the African Union, to please come along and support.
Okay, one quick question. How easy is it for you to coordinate, because you to coordinate with Africa CDC, with the other AU organs and other Pan-African institutions to ensure that you deliver on your mandate? Is that difficult?
For the fund, no, because I mean the fund is an AU creation.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to meet every week. Now we are meeting once a month. And at that meeting, the Africa CDC is there, and you know the members of the board of trustees are drawn from all parts of Africa. So from the way the AU does this thing, they put people from north, east, west, and south, and then they also put from the private sector, and those constituted the trust, the board of trustees. And through that mechanism, we're able to reach the countries where we need to deal with things that are specific to certain regions. The members of the board of trustees that are from that region will take the responsibility for that. With regard to that are being done through the AU, because the secretariat of the board of trustees is at the Africa CDC at the AU. So we have an excellent working relationship with the AU. And of course, the African Export Import Bank has been supporting, not only because I'm from Afreximbank, but also being in the whole spirit of what the bank has been doing, trying to support the continent during this intervention. Of course, just like others, we did our own donations and we paid up. But also making other contributions that are donations, but we are not recording our donations in terms of mm-hmm. even providing the human resources. We are the ones who have hired the fund mobilization consultant, so we are paying the salary for that, and so on and so forth. So you had to
lead by example, I guess.
Yes.
So what is we'll be talking about the response now. So, I mean, you wear so many hats, one of which is head of Afreximbank. So what support, if any, are you giving to countries in post-pandemic recovery?
Well, let me start from what we did to enable them to contain the pandemic. Because we are very familiar with dealing with crisis, because we actually and a bank created out of crisis. In the 80s. That was when it was conceived, when we had the crisis, the debt crisis then. So since the bank was created in 1993, I started operating in 1994, there have been so many crises, and the bank responded. So we it's like we have a two box we can pull out. That was why, as quickly as March, we launched the Pandemic Trade Impact Mitigation Facility, which was a facility created to support our countries to manage to enable them adjust in an orderly manner to the crisis. Using that facility, up to now, we've been able to disburse about $7 billion. And that helped many countries to be able to pay trade debt payments that have fallen due. Because we knew that if we didn't support the countries and the countries started defaulting on trade debt, the recovery would be very, very difficult, because markets have long memories but short vision. So if they defaulted and the things start looking good and it's okay, now come and support me. Oh, but you defaulted yesterday, defaulted last month, defaulted last year. So we wanted to make sure that the countries didn't default and avoid the contagion effect on the continent. And that has been really, really beneficial to the continent. But included in that whole facility is also a $200 million facility with co-launched with the UNECA to support the manufacture of COVID materials within the continent, the PPEs and all that. If you recall, this time last year, everybody was scrambling for all of this, and Africa suffered. So we provided this funding to enable companies to repurpose their factories to produce face masks, simple face masks, and all those PPEs and so on. So now that is about the containment. Now, and going forward, the way we look at it is that, or we looked at it, is that recovery, the financial for economic recovery is vaccine. So you cannot talk about recovery unless you deal with the issue of vaccination of our people. No matter what policy you put, no matter what facility you put in place, without dealing with that fundamental problem, I think we believe it's going to go to waste because you'll be locking down every time. So what did we do? Our board approved a $2 billion facility that then made it possible for the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team through the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Trust to acquire 400 million doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We are members of the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team that was created by the AU back in November. But as you knew, as even today, you would not be able to go and talk to vaccine manufacturers without money behind you. So what we did as a Afreximbank was to provide very possible for the AU member states to procure the vaccines on a pooled basis, working through the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team. So we believe that as those vaccines begin to be delivered this week, that will be the what you're calling the post-pandemic recovery that you're going to see happening in the next couple of months. Then, of course, our facilities that are there to support the countries would then become meaningful. Because we will no longer be worried that, well, you give somebody a facility to do something, tomorrow they lock down the economy, and they won't be able to do anything. So
countries will get the vaccines this week?
Starting this week, yes.
Okay. The World Bank supported that effort, correct?
Well, you know, we started, and then when the idea of all of this was that we had to put the structure that will make it possible for others to come and support. The approach of the World Bank is to deal with country by country. But, you know, you cannot tell a small country to go and negotiate with vaccine manufacturers the way we know it. The vaccine manufacturer will not pay attention. And again, as I mentioned, money, money, money. So we had to work with the under the auspices of the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team to create a structure that would enable a pooled procurement. So when we created a structure that enabled that pooled procurement, we were able to begin to negotiate 400 million doses. But you cannot negotiate 400 million doses for that going to billions of dollars without money. So, and the World Bank would not come in at that time because they would not do a pooled thing. So we had to go ahead and provide the support and pay the down payments of $330 million and all of that. Now, based on that, because we were always discussing with the World Bank and the IMF, the World Bank has now come in to then do what we always wanted them to do, now support the individual countries so that as the vaccines are now being delivered, they use the World Bank finance, which is cheaper than ours, by the way, to be able to then pay for those vaccines. So we've had an excellent relationship with them. The World Bank has been really, really into this. And all of us in the coordinating team of Strive Mercy Iwa, Vera Songwe of UNECA, John Kengasom of South Africa CDC, and myself have been engaging them very, very actively. Also, along with the African Ministers of Health and Finance, we've met twice just to make sure that every country has opportunity. And I must commend the World Bank. They are really eager to support all of them. So that structure has worked perfectly because we have created the vaccines. So we have bought the vaccines. So now we don't have the luxury of having the World Bank go through their own processes to support individual countries to pay for the vaccines.
So the 400 million vaccines, in addition to, I think, less than 100 million that have been administered in countries so far, make it likely that, you know, we are still vaccinating less than half of the population of Africa. Do you have plans to procure more vaccines after this batch?
You see, if everything works as people want it to work, I think we've done our bit. Let me explain to you. The African Union, through the advice of Africa CDC, decided that to achieve herd immunity, that we needed to vaccinate 60% of our population. Of course, at that time, they were expecting the reproductive rate, what they call the R0, to be at a certain level. Of course, with the Delta variant, that has changed, as we learned from Africa CDC the other day. But that was the goal. And through the Gavi COVAX facility, Africa initially was promised 30% support. But then, following discussions we've had with the COVAX people and all that, and the discussions we had at state level, COVAX increased it to 30%. So we knew as Africans we have to go and look for money to do the other 30%. And that is why the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team was focused on finding 30%. And we decided to go for Johnson & Johnson for several reasons, including that it's a single-dose vaccine. So when we then procured the 400 million doses, don't forget 400 million doses is 800 million double-dose vaccine. So when you have 400 million, for 400 million people, our target is 60% of our population. And it's about 800 million Africans to be vaccinated.
So, I don't understand. Okay, each vaccine vaccinates two people?
No. You know, if you are taking, for example, AstraZeneca or Pfizer or Moderna, you have to take two times to vaccinate one.
Right.
So if I tell you I've given you 100 doses of any of those, Pfizer or Moderna.
That's 50 million people,
But Johnson & Johnson is single dose.
Right.
So if I tell you I have 100 doses of Johnson & Johnson, it's 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
So what we bought is Johnson & Johnson, 400 million doses. So 400 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Of the about 800 million Africans that we need to vaccinate to achieve 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget that COVAX promised us 30% of our people. So if they do their own 400,
and you do your 400, that's 800.
But we've done our 400. We've done it. So it'll be 800. That's what we are done.
Yeah. So are they coming through on their promise to provide 400 million doses?
Of course, there have been disappointments, as you know, you are very aware, because so we're all in the newspapers everywhere. By now, we know where we ought to have been, if they have been delivering as planned. But, you know, there are issues from India. The most of the doses were supposed to come from India. The India's placed an export ban, so they never got the deliveries. There were issues about countries who pledged to give them money, not giving, or something like that. But I'm not an expert on what happened there. But I think that there is now a realization that something has to happen quickly so that they can deliver on the promises made. Because otherwise, the Africa would continue to lag behind. And we have a two-speed world where some the rich countries have finished vaccinating children. We haven't even vaccinated anybody in that continent. And when you're talking about 100, only 60 million people that have vaccinated. We don't
I think once these 400 vaccines are distributed, we'll come to a point where anybody who says, I want to be vaccinated, we have access to the vaccine. That is very key. So it means that the vulnerable populations are not that will be able to just go and get vaccination before we start to talk about it.
No, we need 800 million. We need to get it. Because otherwise, this virus will build its headquarters in Africa. Yes. You see, we need to get as many people as we need to get herd immunity vaccinated.
But you are not putting any kind of pressure, whether directly or indirectly, on the other group that should bring the other 400 million, are you?
There's a lot of pressure going on. I invite you to go and watch one of the interviews of Mr. Stryber, who is our coordinator, with a few people that are involved in making sure that the vaccinations come. You will see the kind of pressure. And people are responding, by the way. I'm not saying they're not responding. You know that the U.S. government has made some donations.
Right.
And some of them are already being distributed. The French have also announced some donations. They are coming. We think it's this way, through these efforts, sharing of doses, that we can begin to get the 30%. And I must at this on this platform also thank the MasterCard Foundation, who have donated about through the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Trust about almost 67 million doses.
Okay.
That is about $500 million of donation of vaccines. So these are donations that have come in and that will help us to achieve our objective.
Some countries are also engaged in bilateral arrangements. In your distribution, do you factor that into it in terms of who gets what quantities of vaccines?
You know, we're not running a donation, so to say. They are doing a commercial deal. It's Covax that's doing donation.
Okay.
I think they are the ones who perhaps are sending. So we deliver to what people ordered. So African countries order through us, and then we buy. So before any country orders, I assume that we have already factored in all the supplies, donations, bilateral, and all that. So and that is why we are not concerned about our vaccines being thrown away, because these are being paid for. So the people will make sure they order the right quantities.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point where we manufacture to a large extent our own pharmaceutical products? And is AfriZimBank involved in anything along that line?
Why not? We have factories. For example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines we are buying, there's a fill and finish being done in South Africa, the Aspen facility. There are many leading facilities where we can do. Here in Egypt, Vaxera, I think they are working to begin producing. There's Algeria, the Nigerians, Senegal, and all those. These are vaccines. But pharmaceuticals, there's a great opportunity. The problem we have is that is access to markets. Let me put it that way. You see, the infrastructure for buying vaccines and buying some drugs does not favor buying from Africa. And that's one of the things we're trying to change, to get those agencies that make those huge orders to rethink their strategy, to give Africa the opportunity to produce. And we've had a very, very fruitful conversation with UNICEF in this regard. And we, as a present bank, are ready, and I know there are banks. We signed an MOU with AFC to collaborate to support the creation of pharmaceutical parks and manufacturing capacities. We just need to make sure that when we create these capacities, there is market for them. We are the market in reality. These drugs are coming to us, but the buyers buy the things that come to us from other markets and then ship it back to us. So we want to change the situation where then they should buy some of it from facilities on the continent, because we, for what we consume. We've all seen the danger of over-concentration of production in a few places. We should diversify production capacity for something so critical as pharmaceuticals. So for global health security, by the way.
Yeah. So the effective implementation of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, assuming that were to come on stream fully, would that help in, you know, consolidating the African market and making it one huge attractive one for pharmaceutical companies, in your view?
Of course, that's one of the big rationale for the AFCFTA. You see, if we have a market that becomes increasingly integrated, not only will it create supply chains, but the market begin increasingly to be consolidated. And we begin to have that buying power, so let me put it that way, that will make it possible for us to produce also within the continent. Because if you see now, that it's almost a single market. People can buy things from any part of Africa. You will see an aggregation of those demands. Because today we have a fragmented market. We don't have information about what happens across the continent. If somebody, there may be something being produced just across the border, but the people in the country near it may not even know what's going on. If I ask an Ivorian whether there is a facility that's manufacturing vaccine in South Africa, tell me no. As today, if I do that, but we know that there is. So we have to deal with the information issue, and the AFCFTA will help us deal with it. And when we deal with it, we begin to consolidate the market, and we begin to change the narrative on the continent.
You spoke about lack of infrastructure earlier. I want to talk, do we have the technology in Africa? At a certain level that will enable us to catalyze the kind of vision that you are talking about?
Well, technology in what sense?
I mean, technology, for example, to manufacture pharmaceutical companies, or even to have access to the technology that Western companies have, because sometimes they build a wall around this. They just don't let it out.
Technology is the issue of intellectual property, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's also knowledge is cumulative. I agree with you. There are people who are ahead of us, but I will invite you to take your mind back to say 35 years ago, 40 years ago. Was China where it is today? Did he have the technology then that he has today? So the way to go about it is to find a way to foster the transfer of technology first, especially for something that will give us health security. And at Afreximbank, we know that that is critical. And that's why we have a facility for it. Because when people are talking about manufacturing, they haven't looked at those soft issues you just mentioned. So we have a facility that we put in place to make it easier for companies to license their technologies to African manufacturers. So we guarantee payment of the royalties or license fees. We guarantee that the licenses will be used in accordance with the terms. We guarantee that the nothing will be expropriated. Those are the immediate things, the way to transfer the technology. The other way is what people don't want, where people steal the technology and all that. We are not advocating that. We want a fair and also transparent transfer of technology. And we also then begin to create the capacity in strengthening our educational institutions so that our people can also begin to contribute to global knowledge and begin to also own those intellectual property. That is the way we think things will evolve. And we support it. We support it in many ways, including what I just said, not only helping to pay for access to technology, that is in the short term, not only and also to help to finance the manufacturing, but over time to also support our people in beginning to create the technology to what the African CDC director called co-creation. We can co-create with others because we have local knowledge here. Most of the things you see in terms of resources, if you look at the biodiversity we have here, that has helped feed the drug industry, it's amazing. So we can co-create. We just need to begin to pay attention to those things.
Okay, a couple of quick questions, and then we'll be done, I promise. One, the Pan-African Payment Settlement System, which you champion, what is the status of that now in Africa?
Oh, thank you very much. That's something we are passionate about. I can tell you that all the pilot countries in the West African Monetary Zone, the 6 pilot countries, are live. So the piloting is starting this week. We are also simultaneously beginning to onboard countries beyond the pilot so that as soon as we finish the pilot, they join. You see, this is going to be a big game changer for the continent, because what it does is that it makes it easier for us to make payments across the continent. Again, every time I talk about the 55 fragmented countries that have systems that are just broken up, so this will begin to integrate payments. Today, I can't remember exact percentage of in trafficking, that is somebody in country A in Africa going to country B in Africa that goes outside Africa before it does that. You know what it costs us per year? About $5 billion in charges a year. We are a poor continent. We shouldn't waste money like that. So this payment.
Do you mean the cost of transacting business through countries outside of the continent, or you mean the physical movement of people from within African countries?
Well, let me explain it to you.
Okay.
Let me explain it to you. Assuming here I am in Egypt, and I'm a Nigerian. I want to transfer money from Egypt to Nigeria. This is a reality. It's not what happens, because I do it. I do the transfer. It goes to another country. It goes to a country outside Africa before it comes to Nigeria. Now, the charges, by the time we're getting it in Nigeria, the person getting it, either I pay X percent of it, so the person can get full amount, or by the time the person gets it, he gets it less than whatever. And it takes time. Sometimes it takes 2 weeks. You follow? Now, we've estimated how much that costs the continent. Forget about the time. It costs about $5 billion a year that we have to pay out. Yes. That is one. So this African Payment Settlement System will begin to deal with this. The second is that if I am in Egypt today, I want to watch my favorite Nollywood movies. If I was an artisan in Egypt, I probably have to go and look for a card that is able to be for payment to be made in US dollars or euro or whatever. Are you following? But the Pan-African payment system changes that for you. So you can just pay in Egyptian pound. The Nigerian producer or whatever of the Nollywood gets a Nigerian naira. So the transaction will go seamlessly. At the time when after the man clears for everybody, settles for everybody. So those who are in the next negative position will then pay dollars. And African Bank is putting the dollar overdraft facilities for the central banks of the different countries to enable them cover when they now have to make that payment in foreign currency, whether euro or dollar or whatever. that has to be done. So what does that do? You see, the trade that is diverted from the continent, because people have to go and earn foreign currency somewhere before they come, even if they can do a business just across the border, we begin to see people begin to look across the border for business. That is what is good. You also begin to see people, the SMEs, becoming integrated into the value chains on the continent. So that is a change that the past will bring.
I mean, I have lived outside of my country. I'm a Nigerian, I've lived outside of Nigeria, many countries in West Africa, and then here in the United States, and I definitely can relate to that. My question would be, why haven't we, I don't know whether it's a question or a comment, why haven't we done this 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Because it's a game changer. So the actual question will now be, when does it come on stream? When can we start to do these transactions without going through all of these?
I told you, all the pilot countries went live as at 2nd of August. Okay. So the piloting is starting. The reason we took the West Africa Monetary Zone, there are 6 countries in the West Africa Monetary Zone.
Mm.
You have Gambia, you have Sierra Leone, you have Liberia, you have Ghana, you have Guinea, you have Nigeria. Now, these 6 countries have 6 different currencies. These 6 countries, one of them is Francophone in terms of the language that we all inherited. And you have Anglophone. You have large economies, Nigeria, they have the smaller economies like Gambia and all that. So it's a kind of a microcosm of Africa. So anything that can go wrong in Africa will go wrong there. So that's why we are doing the pilot there, so that we are able to deal with any bugs, anything that we see as a problem. So that then we go, after that, we then expand it to the entire continent. You ask me why has it started? Anything that will be impactful will go through a tortuous route. Because if it's easy, everybody will do it. The good thing is that the payment system is fully politically backed by a heads of state. So it's something adopted by African heads of state with the African Union. So that is what it is there. The biggest problem is not the money to put the system. That was the easiest thing to do. We finished that a long time ago. There are so many other issues as you can imagine. But we are happy that from day to day we're overcoming them, and hopefully one day we will tell the story.
As people are aware, particularly business leaders who have to do this transaction, are they aware of this development?
We are doing this with the co-created with the central banks. So now, when the pilot started now, the next thing you start seeing is the promotion.
Okay.
So we have a campaign to begin to market it, to promote it. But you will not promote something until it starts operating.
Right.
So that's why we all the arrangements are there to just press the button, and all that will go. You'll start seeing.
So before the end of the year, people will be able to make payments across borders.
Are you going too far away? I'm telling you that the 6 countries are live today.
Okay.
So the pilot, they start doing the pilot, and as soon as the pilot moves and we know that there are no issues, we start a big campaign for it.
Okay.
And I will be surprised.
When it starts, ask your guys to notify me. We have a huge platform for Africa. We'll be able to also put that out.
Oh, that's great. I have to, I will take you up on that. You can imagine that.
Yes, on our platform. So one last one. Generally, we like to ask these questions of the big people in Africa. What impact do you think the AfCFTA will have on Africa's industrialization? Maybe say in another 4 or 5 years.
You know, Africa is 60 years of independence.
Mm-hmm.
We are still commodity dependent economy. The only chance Africa has to turn this around is the AfCFTA. And why is that the only chance? It is because it will begin to integrate our market. It's when it begins to integrate our market, that is when we begin to specialize. Right now, what we are doing is the trade foisted on us by our colonial masters. So we do commodities and ship it. That was where the colonial construct was designed. And the AfCFTA breaks down the borders. Once it breaks down the borders, then we will begin to say, how will it be different from the cocoa in Ghana? The people in Nigeria or Cameroon or Cote d'Ivoire will start doing special chocolates that can go to Ghana, for example. But right now, what do you do? The people in Europe want cocoa, you ship cocoa to them. Everybody ships cocoa to them. So that is the thing we will see. That is what will change the landscape. Of course, it's not going to happen overnight. But I tell you, the moment the AfCFTA was signed, Africa entered the track for an industrial-led development.
Professor Rama, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful time. Chatting with you and gaining your insight and experience on the work that you do in Africa. Thank you for the interview, but also, more importantly, thank you for your work that you do for our beloved continent.
No, thank you very much for this opportunity, and we will let you know once the payment system...
Please, let us know. We'll be happy to put that out as aggressively and robustly as possible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good evening.